Good evening and welcome to Behind the News for June 13, 2002. This is Doug Henwood and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. We've got two segments scheduled for tonight. First, we'll speak with Robert Brenner, author of the book The Boom and the Bubble, identified by
New York Times economic columnist Jeff Madrick, one of the smartest people who writes in that paper. Not that there's a whole lot of competition for that title, but Madrick is a smart fellow. He called that the best guide to our economic history of the Clinton years, and we'll ask Bob Brenner to put recent experience into some kind of longer-term historical perspective. And then about the bottom of the hour, we'll be speaking with, and apologies for my terrible Spanish, Gilberto Buenaño, who is the Vice Minister of Planning and Regional Development in the government of Venezuela. We'll talk to him about what it's like to be in serve in a government which the U.S. seems to want to replace, and a good bit of the Venezuelan elite would like to replace, with armed force or whatever. And we'll talk to him about the coup of several weeks ago and what the Chavez administration hopes to do and what it's like now after the restoration of the Chavez government. And God, speaking of I'm putting together a recorded show for last week when I was out of town at that class conference. It was painful to listen to all the ums I do, so. And I edit out a lot of them, but I must be better practice, get rid of all those ums. It's very embarrassing to listen to oneself on record. All right, now we're joined by Robert Brenner, who is the author, as I said, of the book The Boom and the Bubble, The U.S. and the World Economy, just published by Verso, and also a professor of history at UCLA, and one of the few scholars in any discipline to have the honor of having a whole historical debate named after him, the Brenner debate, about the origins of capitalism. But Robert Brenner has turned his attentions to more recent economic history now, looking at the course of the world economy over the last several decades and what the now deceased boom and bubble in the United States, what role that played and what is likely to follow upon it. Welcome to WBAI, Robert Brenner.
Thanks very much, Doug.
The standard narrative, of course, is that we had a tremendous economy in the late 90s, the whole decade, but especially the late 90s, that there were tremendous technological advances, tremendous growth in productivity, and that maybe things got a little carried away, people got a little too enthusiastic, a little too irrationally exuberant, and now we're having a little bust period, a little pause, but fundamentally, things are okay, and this is a mild recession, and sooner or later, things will recover. You don't agree with that analysis. Why not?
Well, it's a big question. Hard to know exactly where to start, but I guess the place to start would be to with trying to say what did actually happen in the 90s. Is that all right?
That's a good place to start. Sure.
Give a perspective on what actually did happen in the 90s without, you know, going back too far. I think the point of departure for understanding the 90s is what, you know, I've called the long downturn, or what many people have called the long downturn, period of slowed growth beginning in 1973 that followed the great post-war boom. So you have basically much slower growth in the 70s than in the 60s and 50s, slower growth in the 80s than in the 70s, and I think kind of remarkably for your readers, I mean, I'm talking now about for the G7 economies as a whole, for the advanced capitalist economies as a whole, not much faster growth in the whole of the 90s, about the same as in the 80s, despite, you know, the very real American boom of the second half of the 90s. So that's the place to start. Now, the way I see it, the source of the long downturn, which may still be plaguing us, it's not easy to tell, was a serious fall in the rate of profit all across the advanced capitalist countries, and not least in the United States, and focused in the manufacturing sector. So as I see it, the big problem for the world economy over the past couple of decades has been the manufacturing sector and manufacturing profitability. Manufacturing profitability, in turn, under pressure because I think of sort of a long-term, surprisingly difficult problem of overcapacity. That problem, whether that's solved or not, I kind of at the core of where we are now.
Why, first of all, why the focus on manufacturing, and second of all, why the focus on profitability?
Well, good. Focus on profitability, I think the profitability is sort of the key to the sort of the health of capitalist economy because the rate of profit, that is, what you get back on the investment you make, basically the capital stock you have in place, how much you get back, gives you first the surplus that you have available to be able to invest. Secondly, since it's not a planned economy and people don't really know what's coming up next, they have to use the sort of realized rate of profit to figure out what's likely to be the expected rate of profit. That is, they use the rate of profit for telling what business conditions are. And finally, you know, if you, keep sort of the dispersion of the rates of profit constant, if you have a high rate of profit, it's unlikely that shocks are going to hurt the economy. If you have a low average rate of profit, you're going to be hurt by shocks. So the key is the rate of profit to the economy's health. Now, why the focus on manufacturing? Well, because we can see that profitability for the whole of the U.S. economy fell in a very major way, maybe for the private economy, 30% for the 70s, for the 70s and 80s compared to the 50s and 60s. But outside manufacturing, actually, the fall in the rate of profit was not all that great. The major part of the fall occurs in the manufacturing sector, over 40%. So the kind of doing the work, so to speak, in the fall of the rate of profit is the fall of the rate of profit in the manufacturing sector. And because of this disparity between what's happened profitability-wise in manufacturing compared to non-manufacturing, I've tried to argue in this book and other places that what's key is the situation of manufacturing on a world scale and basically the overcapacity in manufacturing on a world scale, which has made it very difficult to mark prices up over costs in the way they would like to do, and the surprising difficulty in getting rid of this shelf of overcapacity, especially given that we've had several recessions and so on. So I see that as the kind of core of the problem and sort of the background condition to understand what happened in the 90s.
So many questions arise up. But let me start with this one. Now, your work has been criticized, this book and also the predecessor, New Left Review essay from a few years ago, for focusing so intently on competition between the major capitalist countries and not focusing at would be more traditional Marxist analysis on, the fight between labor and capital within those economies. Why this attention to competition among the three major poles of the world industrial economy?
Well, as I said, I mean, I think a small note of defense. I mean, in the book I wrote before this one called The Economics of Global Turbulence, I spent a great deal of time actually on the class struggle, which I see as absolutely central to the course of any economy. However, to try to explain actually what happened in the late 60s and 70s when profitability fell and especially why profitability didn't come back, looking at the class struggle and actually what happened, you can see quite clearly this can't be the answer because really starting in the, even as early as the early 60s, the class struggle, unfortunately, from my perspective, very unfortunately from my perspective, is actually going against labor and going in favor of capital. And certainly anyone could see that by the end of the 70s, the big labor upsurges in the United States and Europe had been defeated. And over the course of the 80s, you couldn't you know, you could barely have a more pro-capital decade if it were not for the 90s. So to be able to see why, first of all, the rate of profit fell when the class struggle was not going against capital, and above all, why the economy has not recovered. It certainly didn't recover by 1990. Profitability at the end of the 80s is as low as the end of the 70s. You have to, I think, look beyond the class struggle. The class struggle, you know, I wish it had gone better. I wish we could have attributed our problems to labor, because then we would have had a kind of a much stronger labor movement to be depending on now. But I don't think that's the case. You know, the sort of more positive way of looking at it, rather than simply say, well, it wasn't labor, is to say, look, what could account for the fact that profitability fell so sharply in manufacturing and did not fall out, or hardly fell at all, outside manufacturing? The pressure of labor, if anything, was greater in terms of the growth of wages outside manufacturing than in. Productivity growth was obviously much stronger in manufacturing than in non. Yet, in other words, what I'm saying is cost pressures, traditional cost pressures, were stronger outside manufacturing than in. Unit labor costs were much more of a problem. But nonetheless, the rate of profit fell in manufacturing rather than there, and we can see why. Because prices could not be raised to anything like the extent in manufacturing than in non-manufacturing. So you can actually trace the progress of costs pressing down on profits, actually greater in non-manufacturing than manufacturing. But because they could raise prices in non-manufacturing in a way they could not in manufacturing, where international competition and overproduction was so great, that shows the reason for the disparity and the reason for the focus on the manufacturing profit rate.
I'm speaking with Robert Brenner, who is a professor of history at UCLA and author of The Boom and the Bubble, The U.S. and the World Economy, just published by Verso. Why is it that, in the U.S. we see a great reported burst in productivity, especially in the late half of the decade, a decline in unit labor costs, and the last couple of quarters, just truly phenomenal numbers on productivity. Why weren't they able to get profit rates up high enough, and why are they sagging again?
Okay. I think this is the, $64,000 question. Just for your listeners, if they look at the period 95 to 2000, I think there's two things you have to look at. One, by any measure, this was not a particularly spectacular period, because if you look at the period 48 to 73, that quarter century, by every single one of the major macroeconomic indicators, the economy in 95 to 2000 was not doing any better. So that's one side of the picture. The other side of the picture, however, is a very major increase in economic dynamism compared to what was going on in the 70s, 80s, and early 90s. So there's no gainsaying that you really had a very dynamic period, the second half of the 90s. The question is, what was driving it? Now, I would say there's really two aspects to what made the boom. And they're very contradictory aspects. The first aspect was that in the period 85 to 95, there really is a very major recovery in profitability in the United States focused on the manufacturing sector. And I believe this is the real basis for the boom of the 90s, that it had a real basis. And by 1993, 1994, you're getting a big increase in the rate of investment, in investment growth, which is driving this boom. So in the first instance, the boom had a real basis, and the basis was in the recovery of competitiveness of the U.S. economy through devaluation, through keeping wages down for a decade between 85 and 95, through tax breaks to the corporation, through fall in the real interest rate. So real costs went very favorable to capital. There really was a recovery of what you call potential profit rate, and they realized this by increasing investment. So around 1995, it could have looked like things were going to go quite well. But the obverse side of this was really very difficult for the U.S.'s leading allies, trading partners and competitors, because the same things that helped the U.S. economy, that is, the huge devaluation of dollar, 40-60%, flat real wages, where their wages keep going up since they have a relatively slightly more humane economies than we do, they didn't have the kind of tax breaks. They didn't get the advantages that the Fed gave the U.S. Capitalists. So while the U.S. is beginning to do very well, the European and Japanese economies are experiencing their worst period of the post-war period, 1995, deep recessions. And what happens in 1995 is the Japanese yen, I mean, this sounds like a kind of a insider economic story, but it's a very big one. The Japanese yen has risen to like 80 to the dollar, quadruple its rate in the early 70s. And the Japanese economy is coming to a halt. The U.S. has just had faced this huge Mexican peso crisis. And the result is that they feel they have to bail out the Japanese economy, what they do, and the German economy as well. So they decide, and I think it's a very historic turning point for the 90s and for the world economy since, is they decided to push up the dollar. The low dollar had been a key to the U.S. revival. They decide to push the dollar up. And that, to me, transformed the situation. And here's what happened as I see it. Money poured into the United States in 1995 from Japan, of course, to get the yen down, the dollar up, from East Asia to keep their currencies from falling, from going back up, from all over the world. This pushed down real interest rates, and money started to pour into the stock market because they knew the dollar was going up and because there was a lot of money around and interest rates were going down. Also, you may remember Alan Greenspan lowered short-term interest rates then in response to the Mexican peso crisis. So 1995 is this huge turning point. And this change in the dollar, it seems to me, almost determines the rest of the decade. And it determines a very contradictory boom as follows. One, now you have, you asked, what about profitability in the second half of the 90s? Well, because the dollar goes up by 25%, 20%, the rise in manufacturing profitability is put to a stop. Indeed, manufacturing profitability would have fallen beginning right at starting 1995, except that wages were negative, real wages were negative in 95 and 96.
And just to point out to listeners, the rise in the dollar makes U.S. exports more expensive at the same time as it makes imports seem cheaper to U.S. purchasers. So
exactly.
It's a double whammy for U.S. manufacturers.
Exactly. So U.S. producers, which had been enjoying a radically falling dollar and therefore cheap exports and expensive imports, now had to face the opposite. So Doug's question was, what happens to profitability in the second half of the 90s? Well, ironically, starting in 1997, I think Doug's reported this in his own newsletter, starting toward 1997, after 1997, you have a fall in the manufacturing rate of profit as this boom is reaching its height by about between 15-17%, and at the same time, a fall in the non-financial corporate rate of profit by about 9%. So this is happening as the boom is reaching its peak. Now, how could this be? Well, I said that the origins of the boom can be found in the recovery of profitability and the much better condition of manufacturing. And I'm saying, well, manufacturing is going into the toilet. How could the boom continue? Well, here is the point about the dollar and the stock market. The same rising dollar that undercuts manufacturing profits and undercuts manufacturing competitiveness is helping to drive the stock market up. As the stock market goes into orbit, the corporations and also rich households find themselves with massively increased paper wealth. So the corporations can either borrow much more, which they did, or in some cases where they're not such powerful corporations, sell their stocks at an incredibly overinflated value. They have almost zero cost for capital. Meanwhile, wealthy consumers, wealthy households are able to buy as they've not been able to buy before. So you have this huge irony. Profitability is going down, yet the capital at the disposal of the corporations and the consuming power of the economy based on the huge growth of debt is going up. So you're able, in the second half of the 90s, to continue this huge investment boom on the basis of very cheap capital. I believe that there was a serious increase in productivity at the same time, especially in manufacturing, but also in the economy as a whole, not the kind of thing at all that the publicists speak of, but serious, real. But because this boom was being driven by the stock market, and the stock market was rising as profitability fell, you couldn't have it continue. The first sign of the problem is with the Asian crisis in the end of 1997, 98. The Fed comes in and saves the boom by, saying we want lower interest rates and we want the stock market to rise, so it rises again to even higher levels. And, of course, this is the period of the high-tech boom, so there's gigantic investment in that period. And the boom continues, but profitability is now falling. And by 2000, as you've reported, Doug, and as everyone knows, people start around the spring. All the e-businesses begin. People begin to notice, hey, these guys have not made any profits ever. And there's reports on this, and the e-business starts to fall. And then in the middle of the year, you get the really serious stuff with the leading high-tech companies. They're not making profits, and the stock market falls. The stock market falls, and then the wealth effect that had been driving the economy forward now goes into reverse. So corporations are not only facing low profitability, but they're not able to take advantage any longer of high stocks. So investment goes into reverse. Final point and kind of the bottom line of the situation we're facing. In that period of 97 to 2000, as profitability is falling, there was this huge investment in the face of reduced profitability. So as I see it, the bottom line problem that faces the U.S. economy is huge overcapacity. Indeed, the overcapacity problem that was implicit already becomes very great by 2000, because profitability has fallen, yet there's all this investment that couldn't justify itself on the basis of a good profit rate. So when the stock market falls, the corporations are sitting with all of this capital that they just created, they are therefore stuck with a tremendous reduction in profitability. Manufacturing profits fell by half. Manufacturing profits are half their level of 2000 now, and the profit rate in the non-financial corporate sector at the end of 2001 was below any point since the early 80s. So the short story, the boom defied... the bubble defied the profitability. The boom defied profitability. The boom and the bubble were brought in line by profitability, and that's what we're facing right now. The overcapacity, that's the sort of the byproduct of that boom.
All right, I want to ask you, you've just been listening to Robert Brenner, who is a professor of history at UCLA and author of The Boom and the Bubble, The U.S. and the World Economy, just published by Verso. And I want to ask you for your prognosis, but just before we get to that, there are a lot of people who say that speaking of the world economy in national terms is kind of an obsolete convention. Production now has become so globalized and so dominated by multinationals that operate in 50 or 100 countries that just doesn't make any sense to talk of an American or a Japanese or a German economy anymore. It's all just one big world thing. You speak a lot about national economies. Why do you do that?
Well, I mean, there is a tremendous a globalization of the world economy. And while there is, one of the central points of my work is that you cannot look at the evolution of, say, the American economy, even the American economy, in separation from the rest of the world economy, and sort of a central point of mine that, say, the U.S. recovery up in the first half of the 90s couldn't sustain itself precisely because of international interdependence and the difficulties that was facing the rest of the world as the U.S. began to recover. While I would say that, nonetheless, it strikes me that there is still, you cannot in any way cease to talk about national units, not least because, despite what everyone says, national policy is so important, and especially, for example, the national policy of this little country called the United States, which I believe has, been the, central to the evolution of the 90s. First, I would say, as I said, in terms of these exchange rates, which have, for example, if you look at the exchange rates, low exchange rates for the U.S., the U.S. economy, made the U.S. boom. High exchange rates for Japan and Europe made Europe go down, Europe and Japan get into trouble. So here is just the first and an obvious place in which the national perspective is absolutely central. But, it's even policy, where people say, oh, policy doesn't really matter, you can't have national policy. Well, the Federal Reserve's policy, as Doug, as you yourself have shown very well, at crucial points, has been absolutely central. The reduction of interest rates by about 5% at the real interest rates at the beginning of the 90s saved the U.S., and I talk about the U.S., corporate sector, which was incredibly deeply in debt and prevented that recession from being too difficult. The Greenspan's willingness, it's pretty horrific, but Greenspan's willingness essentially to operate the U.S. and therefore the world economy through the stock market is further proof of this. What Greenspan decided to do basically after 95 was not to raise interest rates while the stock market was going up. This meant that corporations could essentially get their money for free. What they did was they borrowed some money for investment, but they also borrowed an awful lot of money to buy back their own stocks, which pushed the stock market up higher. And as I said, it's the wealth effect of the stock market boom that was driving the economy in the second half of the 90s. So I would say that in the old traditional sense of economic policy and national economic policy, you have to still look at the world as divided into national economies. I think also corporations are still have a national base, although I would want to agree with those people who are saying the trend is the opposite and the people are concerned with production chains and all this are looking at the right thing. Still, if you want to see, you want to do an empirical analysis like I've tried to do, or tell a story, a narrative of, what went wrong what went wrong in the U.S. economy in the 90s, I think you can and must do it by looking at the U.S. sector, U.S. policies, and so on. I wouldn't say that if I were sitting in the Netherlands, I could make the same kind of statement, maybe, but given the tremendous role of the U.S., given the tremendous role of the EEC, given the tremendous role of Japan, and the tremendous power of all of those, I don't think you can say that we have become an economy without borders. We definitely have states, and states are very, very important.
We only have less than a minute left, but let me just ask you one final question. It looks like the downward momentum in the U.S. economy peaked out or bottomed out late last year, and maybe the recession sort of ended then, but the recovery since then has been extremely weak and tentative. Just how long do you think this is going to go on? Are we on the verge of the big one, or is this just going to take a little while to recover from, or just how bad is it going to be?
I would say that the outlook is gray or poor. It's crazy to predict catastrophe. I shy away from doing that. But I think that if you look at what's driven the recovery, it's very clear. The recovery, Greenspan lowered interest rates. That's the key thing. But, you know, spectacular lowering of interest rates. But what I think is most spectacular is that there was no investment recovery as a result. Because of this overcapacity in manufacturing, he was, in the Keynesian phrase, pushing on a string. So the interest rates reduction failed completely in that sort of fundamental sense. On the other hand, it succeeded incredibly well in the other sense. That is, it made for a gigantic boom in household debt. Household debt had risen faster in 2001, first part of 2002, than even in the 90s, which is incredible. And that rise in household debt has driven the recovery. So the real question is, can that growth in household debt, it, you know, as it were, autonomously kick off an investment boom? I'm kind of skeptical, because it seems to me that what you've had is rising unemployment, which is making the growth of debt more difficult. You have a falling dollar, which is making interest rates go up a little bit. I think this is the gap that they're trying to fill between a spectacularly rising household debt, rising consumption, and a not yet emergent investment boom, because profitability is so low, because overcapacity is so great.
I'm afraid we have to end it there, Bob.
I don't know that, but I think that's the framework to look at it.
All right, thank you very much. And for people who want to fill out the framework, they can get Robert Brenner's book, The Boom and the Bubble, The U.S. and the World Economy, just published by Verso. And let's hear this little political economy lesson from Stereo Lab, and then we'll be back to talk to Gilberto Buendino.
It's all right, 'cause that historical pattern has shown how the economic cycle tends to revolve in a round of decades. Three stages stand out in a loop. Spell for more than yield back to spell one back for more. Bigger slop and bigger wars and a smaller recovery. Three huger slump and greater wars and a shallower.
And in case you couldn't understand that EU accent, it's all right, because the historical pattern has shown how the economical cycle tends to revolve in a round of decades. Three stages stand out in a loop, a slump and war, and then peel back to square one, and then back for more. Bigger slump and bigger wars and a smaller recovery, huger slump and greater wars and a shallower recovery. Don't worry, be happy. Things will get better naturally. And this is Doug Henwood. The show is Behind the News, WBAI 99.5 FM in New York. And on the web, WBAI.org. And by the way, that was from Stereo Lab's 1994 album, Mars Audiac something or other. And now we're joined by Gilberto Buendino, and I apologize for my terrible Spanish, who is a vice minister of planning and regional development in the government of Venezuela, trained as an architect, educated here, among other places, at Kent State and University of California, Berkeley, and now handling regional development issues in the government of Hugo Chavez in Venezuela. Welcome to WBAI. Are you with us, Gilberto Buendino?
Yes, yes, yes. Hello. How are you doing, Doug?
Good. Welcome to our show. What's it like now serving in a government that was briefly thrown out of office and then restored? You guys like worried about people storming in with machine guns any day now, or what?
Well, yes, it's kind of unbelievable in different senses. You know, over the past several years, Venezuela, under the leadership of President Hugo Chavez, has been trying to elaborate an alternative path of development to the neoliberal model, because many Venezuelans believe that this model has not brought to the poor peoples of the world the benefit that it has promised. I call this an alternative, the Venezuelan way. This has come under heavy criticism from both within and outside Venezuela, and that's something that can be perfectly understandable. What is not understandable, how a very democratic system where the freedom of the press and the freedom in general has been very well respected has come under the attack of the attempt of a military coup. That is something that makes us very uncomfortable, because if we live in a free world, we should use the democratic means to put forward our ways of thinking. So, you know, and at this moment, it's kind of difficult for us to understand why, if people are not interested or do not agree with the Venezuelan way, should use means like, violent means to overthrow a government. So, you know, little by little, we are trying to put forward not only the idea that this Venezuelan way should continue, but also that if people do not like the way this new government is working, they should use democratic means to convince the rest of the people that the way we are trying to build a new country is, not welcome by other people. But in general terms, what has been shown to the world is that most of the Venezuelan people are in favor of this government, and these people have been against these violent attempts to overthrow the government.
Well, I think it was a member of the Clinton National Security Council who said in the early 90s sometime that democracy only works when there's fundamental agreement of the nature of property. And I think that what means they mean by that is that democracy only works when the neoliberal model is accepted. And they showed that there are certain limits to the tolerance of democracy. But let's leave that aside for now and just get some sense of what you and your colleagues in the government of Venezuela are trying to do. I mean, the odds against a small country running an economic policy on its own and against the general drift of what the rich and the powerful in the world want, the odds are against a country like that. I mean, how do you see what you're trying to accomplish within those tremendous international constraints?
Yeah. See, I would say that what this new government is trying to do could be, synthesized in different manners. But I would say that I would put some of the ideas that have been the guidance of this government, but at the same time, they have been heavily criticized. For instance, about democracy that you were talking about, and it's a subject. The Venezuelan way has been accused of being anti-democratic and even tyrannical since 1998 when President Hugo Chavez got into power. But nevertheless, election for the legislature under the old constitution has been run. Presidential election has been taking place. Referendum as to whether the new constitution should be written or not also took place. Election for delegates to the Constitutional Convention took place. Referendum to accept the new constitution took place. Election for president, congress, governor, state legislator, and mayors under the new constitution took place. And also election for city, town councils, neighborhood committees under the new constitution. So we have had seven elections, all won by margin. So how can they call this process being anti-democratic? In terms of freedom of expression, also the mass media have continually accused the Venezuelan government of attacking their freedom of expression. Nevertheless, you see every day in Venezuela the mass media put forward a point of view critical of what is going on in the country, which is okay with us. So, we have to have a healthy opposition to whatever the government is doing. Until the 11, April 11 to 14, the mass media have been reported. Nobody has been reported jail or newspaper closed or the radio station or television station closed. Nevertheless, we try to build a new way in democracy and freedom and also peacefully. In terms of the Catholic Church, for instance, which in Venezuela, a Catholic country, has been accused of being anti-Catholic Church. Nevertheless, in Venezuela, there is a deep spiritually with this, you know, sense, and also not only for Catholic Church, but all kind of religion has been flourishing during this period. In terms of militarism, which is also something that Venezuela has been accused, or this way has been accused, for having a military and tyrannical land, for instance. But the concept of national security found in the Venezuelan constitution differs substantially from the early visions based on the bipolar confrontation between East and West. The security of the nation is seen as the mutual responsibility of the military and the civil sector, for instance. Then the military sector has been participating in development matters in the country. They help to distribute food or to incorporate in the management of some of the important institutions in Venezuela, teachers, medical aids, and so on and so forth. The military equipment has been used to rebuild, for instance, Vargas, a state that suffered very much in a tragic events in 1999. In terms of economic strategy, the economic policies of the Venezuelan way are attacked for unsustainable for the region. But what have we done is that the new constitution does not propose a centrally planned economy controlled by a single party. Neither the constitution proposes a neoliberal approach. Neither of these two extremes. We have been working together, assuming that the cooperative movement, the large producer, the small producer, the single producer can be an economic important element to the building of a new economy. So we have been building a model where with social responsibility, with the support of cooperatives to assist private investment, both Venezuelan and foreign, but within the context of sustainable development. So we don't want to, with very good care of the people, very good care of the environment, and very and thinking in the future generations. So in terms of social organization, the Venezuelan way has been criticized for promoting a form of social organization which we call the Bolivarian circles, that are essentially has been accused of being essentially a paramilitary kind of paramilitary organization. But Venezuelan society has one of the highest levels of inequality in America, which in turn has been has the highest inequality of any region in the world, in spite of you know being a having natural rich in being rich in natural resources like oil, and we have to organize the population and attend directly to the population, and in that sense the population have been organized in what we call Bolivarian circles to help their development. They don't practice war, or they don't use weapons. What they do is build the future of the communities. Also, we have been criticized for being opposed to free trade unions, for instance, or to the unions. But the unions in Venezuela are not elected, for instance, and the new constitution demands that the election must take place also in labor unions, and that hasn't happened. And that has, for that matter, the government has been accused for not respecting the labor unions. In terms of international relations, Venezuela also has been criticized for supporting enemies, in quotation marks I would put them, enemies of democracy around the world. But Venezuela is a founding member of OPEC organization. In 1998, the price of oil was very low, unfairly low, and it was the subject of erratic fluctuations. And then we took a very important role in OPEC. We have to meet Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, Iran, Kuwait, Libya, Iraq, and Qatar, all members, but also non-OPEC members, like Russia, Mexico, Norway, and we work together a scheme to have a better prices for oil, fair prices for oil. And so when we talk to our partners in OPEC, we cannot discriminate between the enemies of other nations and not enemies. We are members of OPEC. It's like when we are in the United Nations, we cannot meet only what with part of the member and not with the other. So we are developing this kind of relationship with many partners in around the world. On the other hand, Venezuela is a member of the Andean Community and the Organization of Caribbean Countries, and both areas want to contribute to the process of peaceful integration and development. Together with European countries and the United Nations, we have offered peaceful solutions, for example, to Colombia. Together with Mexico, we provide petroleum to Central America, which includes, for instance, Cuba. But not only Cuba, also Costa Rica and Nicaragua, and so on and so forth. And for that matter, we have been accused of supporting enemies of democracy. But we have to understand that in this world, we have to have relationships, fair relationships, and healthy relationship with all members of the world community.
Well, that's not always pleasing to Washington. Let's talk. I should say I'm speaking with Gilberto Buenaño, who is the Vice Minister of Planning and Regional Development in the government of Venezuela. I want to talk a bit about oil in the Venezuelan economy. Oil is very important in Venezuela, Venezuelan economy. Very often, oil-rich countries, oil-exporting countries, have a social structure that goes with it of extreme inequality, extreme maldevelopment, and also ecological destruction. Does this characterize Venezuela?
Sure, of course. That's one of the problems that we now can say caused this attempt to overthrow the government. The government has conducted a policy that is oil policy that is environmentally concerned. For instance, we don't think that the solution for Venezuela is to produce more and more oil, no matter how cheap it is. Our concern about environmental matters is that the more you use the oil, the more you contaminate the world, not only Venezuela, but also the rest of the world. So we have to have a very concerned, environmentally concerned policy in terms of oil, but also in terms of social matters. We are doing our best to diversify our economy and to rely more in renewable resources rather than unrenewable resources. The oil which we exploit today and sell today will not be there tomorrow, but the contamination will be there. So we better diversify our economy instead of relying only in oil. That also has been... So some people have seen this as unfriendly policy because we don't supply as much oil as the world wants, but it's a matter of concern for all the countries in this earth, of all the citizens of this earth, to explore new sources of energy, cleaner sources of energy, less contaminating. So, this has been not well understood for some worldwide actors that believe that this is an unfriendly policy, but we have to be concerned about the future. And so not only in terms of in economic terms, but also in social terms. So our population that has suffered this this common situation in oil economies, that extreme inequalities and harm for the environment have to change in the case of Venezuela. And that's part of what we are doing.
Having
a better distribution of the oil wealth and also betterment of the social conditions. Yeah.
Of course, Venezuela is a very important supplier of oil to the United States, and cheap oil is like the American national religion. So, anything that threatens cheap oil is sacrilegious. But could you tell me a bit about what you're trying to do to diversify the Venezuelan economy away from oil? What kinds of development schemes you've got going?
Yeah, that's a very important thing. Venezuela is about 1 million square kilometers, and that territory live only about 24 million people. most of which live in the northern part of the country, in the Caribbean Sea coast. This has been a pattern of occupation of the country, which has been the product of the oil economy, which brings money or dollars to the country and buys everything that the country needs overseas. As a result of that, we have not developed the rest of the economy. For instance, in agriculture matters, even though we have a very good quality land to plant whatever we need, we still rely. For instance, in the last 20 years, Venezuela has sold 4 billion dollars, but has bought $30 billion. It's a net transference of capital of $30 billion that otherwise could be used to support the national development. But that happened because we rely only in the oil economy. So how to diversify? One of the first steps is to promote the rural development of the country, but with an integral sense of the development. We have at this moment a program called SARAO, which stands for Self-Sustainable Auto-Organized Towns or Little Villages, where we work together at the same time with the organization of the people, the production of the land, but also the construction of the society, because traditionally in Venezuela, being in the countryside, being a peasant is like being a citizen of third or fourth class. So peasants in the countryside were totally abandoned. So we think that we can bring to the countryside all kind of facilities like health, schools, roads, communication, and so on. So this program brings together 24, 48, because it's organized in a community of minimum 12 families, and then these 12 families have financing, have housing, have communication, and so on, for the families and for the wealth for the development of the place where they live. This has been very successful because we have increased the agricultural production with this program. With this program, we have already about 3 years. For instance, this is one way of in practical terms aid to the diversification of the economy, but also in the already establishments, industrial establishment, and so on and so forth, we have incorporated the organization of cooperatives, production the production of different services and goods. For instance, in textiles, usually this was mainly imported, and now we are producing our own textiles, but in cooperatives, organizing a lot of people who didn't have employment, that were unemployed, because the oil industry has this other characteristic that it doesn't provide enough job for the people. It's a very capital-intensive kind of production, not labor-intensive. So we are also in diversifying economy, making efforts in sectors of the economy which are highly intensive in labor.
Well, we're just about out of time, but just one final question. Do you see any signs that the coup plotters, domestic and their friends in Washington, are likely to strike again, or are they do they feel defeated?
The fact of the matter that this attempt occurred tell us that it's possible to happen again. But what is clear at this moment is that the Venezuelan population is very much in favor of the government, and most of the population went out to the street to defend this government, to defend this democracy. Next time we were very lucky that a bloodshed didn't occur. But next time, either they attempt with a stronger, more violent means, or they will receive a larger rejection from the population. We don't want to get to that point. At this moment, the answer that the military sector gave was very clear. They are in favor of the constitution. They are in favor of legality and in favor of democracy. So they don't have the support in this area at the moment. And of course, there is always a possibility, and people who may attempt to do so. But the demonstration that they gave in 48 hours of what they wanted to do showed the population that it is not what Venezuela wants, and it is what Venezuela is against. So, you know, people with lack of intelligence and lack of health, good purposes may attempt to do that, but they must be also prepared to be rejected in a very massively way by the population.
All right, we have to end it there. Thank you for joining us, Gilberto
Hernando,
who is Vice Minister of Planning and Regional Development in the government of Venezuela. And that's it for me, Doug Henwood. Stay tuned for the news and on to the evening. And let's go out with this version of the Internationale by Alistair Hewlett, a Scottish singer. Just a little excerpt I found on the web. Can't find the whole thing, but here we go.
Arise, ye works from your slumber. Arise, ye prisoners of want. For reason and revolt now thunders, and at last ends the age of cant. Away with all your superstition, servile masses, arise, arise. We'll change henceforth the old tradition, we'll spurn the dust to win the prize. Ah, so comrades, come rally, and the last fight let us face. The Internationale unites the human race. As our comrades come rally, and the last fight let us face. The Internationale unites the human race.